This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. We're live this morning with analysis of the Iowa caucuses from Republican political analyst Michelle Ertel and former Democratic state lawmaker Dick Batchelor. Voters turned out in Iowa last night, weighing in on the men and women running for the White House. On the Republican side, much of the attention may have been on the front runners, Tea Party favourite Texas Senator Ted Cruz and bombastic billionaire Donald Trump. But on Intersection this morning, we're going to talk about Floridian candidates Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio. Jeb Bush entered the race last year with a big war chest and was seen by some as an establishment favourite. But Bush's super PAC, Right to Rise, has seen its fundraising dip, and Bush's poll numbers have also tumbled since he got in the race, eclipsed by outspoken frontrunners Donald Trump and Ted Cruz, and by his one-time protege, South Florida Senator Marco Rubio. As Jeb Bush's poll numbers slid last year, the gloves came off as he took aim at Rubio on the debate stage and tried to reset his campaign. But how successful was that reset for Bush? And just how significant is Iowa for Bush and Rubio? New Hampshire is just 1 week away, and pundits say that state, too, is crucial for both candidates. Well, joining me in the studio, Michelle Ertel. She's a Republican political analyst. Welcome to Intersection.
Good morning.
Also in the studio, former Democratic State House Representative Dick Batchelor. Welcome back, Dick.
Good to be back. Thank you.
Well, first, some reaction to how the polls shook out last night. Michelle Ertel, any surprise in how things shook out there, how Republican Iowans voted for Donald or Cruz?
Well, I think it came out exactly how the pollsters said it was going to come out on the Republican side. You know, Donald Trump and Ted Cruz were neck and neck towards the end. Mm-hmm. The biggest surprise, I think, was Marco Rubio. He showed some momentum in the final weeks. And at the final tally, he got seven delegates. Donald Trump got seven delegates. So there's virtually tied.
Mm-hmm. And his supporters, they've got that hashtag Marcomentum, some of that last night maybe kicking in.
And hashtag Cuban Camelot. You know, he's a feel-good guy.
Mm-hmm. What was your response kind of watching those poll numbers come in, Dick Batchelor?
Well, it's interesting. And the polling in Iowa has been traditionally wrong. And it was interesting. They certainly had Donald Trump up far ahead that where he ended up anyway. And then for Ted Cruz, it's a big win for Ted Cruz. I mean, it gives him some momentum going into New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. But I think he might not do as well there because you got John Kasich, people like that. And that's where Jeb Bush is going to have to make it or break it. He might get as far as South Carolina, but if he doesn't come out of New Hampshire with some ranking, it's going to be hard for him to do that. But very interesting night, but Ted Cruz is a big win for him.
Mm-hmm. Now, Jeb Bush spent a lot of money. You're a super PAC, Right to Rise, spent a bunch of money in Iowa, a lot of ads there. Nothing really to show from it. Big disappointment.
Bad trend too. If you look at it, if you look at the campaigns, Marco Rubio in the last few months have picked up about 119 supporters who actually with Jeb Bush, only about $500,000, but it's still indicative of maybe a trend. People are beginning to leave mm-hmm. you know, Bush and go to Rubio. So that's a bad sign for him. And no matter how much money he spent, he's just not getting any traction. Obviously, no traction in Iowa. New Hampshire, it's going to be, again, make or break. He might make it to South Carolina, but as far as he can go, I think.
Mm-hmm. Michelle, you mentioned that Rubio did surprisingly well by some regards. I mean, he was polling in third place before the caucuses, but really close to Donald Trump. Were you expecting, though, Jeb Bush to do a little better, some kind of upset from him?
No, Jeb Bush didn't put a whole lot of effort into Iowa. In fact, he left Iowa yesterday morning for New Hampshire. He mm-hmm. is putting all of his eggs in the New Hampshire primary. He has legislators and people from Florida, some very, very loyal people up there, and he's got a ground game in New Hampshire. He didn't have a ground game in Iowa. So I think that we will see him as well do well in New Hampshire, as well as Kasich, as well as Christie. I think we're going to see some moderates. And remember, it's an open primary. So mm-hmm. Democrats can vote for Republicans. Republicans can vote for Democrats. So as long as we have some moderate folks like Jeb Bush, they're going to do well in New Hampshire.
And I think it's going to be interesting to see what happens to the people falling by the wayside. Rick Santorum mm-hmm. has got to get out. Huckabee has suspended his campaign and others too. Where will they throw their support? And the other thing I think was really fascinating about Iowa is Trump's a loser. He's now lost the campaign, and does that weaken him going into New Hampshire?
Do you see him spinning it that way, though? Do you see Trump coming out of Iowa and saying, look, guys, I lost?
He'll probably come out and say people in Iowa were stupid, and that's why I lost in Iowa. But seriously, though, I think he's tried to play the best way he can, but he lost.
Mm-hmm. Jeb Bush made a point, though, in the last debate last week leading up into the Iowa caucus. He's like, look, this is, he used the expression beanbag stuff, and things are about to get real. So this was kind of a reality check for Donald Trump.
I think it's a reality check. But keep in mind, I was a caucus state, and it's very different. It had about 157,000 people participate on the Republican side, the biggest turnout they've had, but still that's 157,000 people. Mm-hmm. And getting to New Hampshire doesn't really reflect the rest of the country either. It's a very Caucasian state. There's very few Hispanics and African Americans there, so it doesn't reflect the makeup of the country. But at least it's not a caucus state. It's an election state.
It's a real vote.
A real vote.
Mm-hmm. Let me just come back to the money spent too. Jeb Bush's Super PAC Right to Rise, as we said, spending about $15 million on ads in Iowa. Rubio's campaign, his Super PAC too, his team spending about $12 million, so a lot of money going into that. Michelle Ertel, clearly Jeb Bush must be feeling a little bit of buyer's remorse here.
I think so. But remember, Right to Rise is a Super PAC. He has nothing to do with it. You know, it's a hands-off thing. So I'm sure that Right to Rise is having some buyer's remorse this morning. But, you know, like I said, they left yesterday morning looking forward to New Hampshire, and we'll see how it works out for them there, where he does have a big ground game going on.
Keep in mind, Rubio's strategy has been 3-2-1. He has to come in third in Iowa, second New Hampshire, and first in South Carolina. So far, his strategy works. Early on, it worked so far.
Mm-hmm. What about the money, though, Dick Batcher? If you look at this primary campaign compared to other campaigns, how do those kind of figures tally? Like,
oh, a lot of money. You've probably had the candidates combined spend over $100 million, which is a lot of money just to get out of Iowa, a caucus state.
Mm-hmm. Michelle Ertel, is this the kind of money, though, that a Super PAC needs to spend to secure that 3-2-1 slot, as Dick Batcher was saying?
Absolutely. And, you know, Donald Trump has the money. He hasn't even begun heavy fundraising yet. It's still his own money. So, yes, it's money is critical to winning any campaign.
Mm-hmm. Dick Batchelor, just what kind of calculus goes into deciding how much to spend and when, especially for campaigns which maybe don't have a lot of money to throw around? I mean, there isn't much time now between now and New Hampshire. This is crunch time, but how do they decide whether to keep a little bit of money in the bank, so to speak, going forward?
Maybe that's not a very political term, but campaign and money is like the insatiable mistress. You know, you'll spend as much as you can find, as much as you can get. That will dictate how much you spend. But what would be interesting, too, if you look at Bernie Sanders has 3 million people who contributed to him. He raised $30 million in January, and the average contribution was $27. That's an amazing campaign compared to the PACs that are spending, you know, up to $100 million.
Mm-hmm. Is that similar to what we saw from Barack Obama the first time around?
Actually, more money. More individual contributors and more money.
Mm-hmm. Michelle Ertel, what was your take if we turn now to the Democratic side of the race? Pretty close, neck and neck, with Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton last night. Surprises there, or maybe not so surprising?
Well, I think Hillary Clinton was very surprised that he came so close. And I know the polls were back and forth on that. But, you know, she has national name ID for years and years and years. The Democrats loved her husband. She was Secretary of State. She should have just taken Iowa by storm, and she didn't. She tied with Bernie Sanders, a self-proclaimed socialist, with a huge groundswell of support. So I think Hillary Clinton, we're going to see her scrambling to the left, trying to reach some college kids and some ultra-liberal folks, whereas she was a little bit closer to the middle before.
Mm-hmm. What's your take on that, Dick Batchelor? Does that sound like a sound strategy for Hillary Clinton going forward?
The state of Iowa in this caucus process was a springboard for Bernie Sanders. It was the perfect state for him to run in for the first campaign. 45% of the Democrats polled self-identify themselves as socialist in Iowa. That's not going to happen in New Hampshire, particularly when you get the South Carolina and the SEC states in the South in the March primaries. It's going to be much different than that. People do not identify themselves as socialists in the South, as Democrats.
Just on the way the caucuses work on the Democratic side, too, it's kind of a messy process, right, in Iowa. It seems like a lot of shouting.
It's a fascinating process. The whole caucus process is fascinating, how they convene and you separate everybody in the room, and then they get to give speeches on behalf of their candidates and negotiate who's going to support whom and try to trade off O'Malley's votes. Interesting, about as grassroots as you can get.
Mm-hmm. And New Hampshire, I mean, they're a pretty independent state. I think, Michelle, as you were pointing out, that there are independents who can vote in that primary too. So they tend to kind of do their own thing. So, you know, how much weight should we put on these two states when you look at how the campaigns are going?
Well, first of all, New Hampshire could surprise everybody because they might say you get your up-and-comers in New Hampshire. After you come out of Iowa, you're going to kind of beat you back down a little bit. So it'll be very interesting to see what comes out of that. But those two states combined really don't reflect this, you know, the country. The fact is, even Bernie and looks like Bernie and Hillary are very, very close. Mm-hmm. Maybe she edged it out by maybe three or four different votes. But the fact is, you need 2,042 delegates. And the fact is, if you look at the superdelegates, most of them have committed to Hillary. She's way ahead in delegates. And that's what you need to win, is delegates, not votes.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. We're live with political analysis of the Iowa caucuses and a look ahead to New Hampshire with Dick Batchelor and Michelle Ertel. I'm wondering, Michelle, if you look at it, kind of take an outside view, is there as much at stake in these early primary states, early caucuses for the Democratic candidates as there is for the Republicans?
Well, I think it's equal. I think that for any of them, it's an opportunity for them to get some momentum. And when you win first, second, or third place, the parties throw money at you. So I do think it's a good thing, and it's a lifeline for candidates that are just hanging on by a thread. You know, Rick Santorum, the last time he came out of nowhere and he won Iowa, and it was able to propel him forward a little bit, not that much. So,
And the difference is the other candidates have a campaign and they've got a strategy and they've got money. Ted Cruz has their individual PACs they're supporting him, so he'll have the money to hang on. What's going to be fascinating is the people who drop out. Who do they endorse? Do they endorse Trump?
Mm-hmm.
Are they really try to peel off kind of an establishment candidate like Marco Rubio? This is where Marco Rubio gets his strength. Right now, Trey Gowdy in South Carolina has endorsed him. It looks like Senator Tim Johnson, the only African-American in the U.S. Senate, is going to endorse him in South Carolina, which hurts Bush. So it depends on where they break. If those get out of the race, do they break towards the establishment candidate, which might be Marco Rubio now, or do they break towards Trump?
Mm-hmm. Well, haven't we seen an indication of that already last week? When the debate was going on, you had Donald Trump. He was running his own kind of rival event. And we had Mike Huckabee. We had Rick Santorum appearing at that event. Michelle Ertel, does that sort of give you a sense of where they're throwing their support behind?
It sure looks like it. Or because Huckabee and Santorum knew that they weren't going to get any FaceTime on Fox, they just jumped to CNN, to Donald Trump's counter-programming event. So they may throw their support behind Trump because I think that maybe they feel as if the party has not supported them. So why not?
When you look at Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio, how they campaigned in Iowa, you know, what they have to show for it coming out and what worked for them, what should have they done differently, if we can kind of Monday morning quarterback this?
Well, you know, the air wars, you know, the mailers and the TV and the radio doesn't necessarily work on folks from Iowa. They want to see the candidates in their living rooms playing video games with their children, throwing football on Thanksgiving Day. Mm-hmm. They want to see them become part of the community. And I think that Donald Trump did not do that. And by the way, he did surprisingly well for not doing that. But Ted Cruz and his folks, they were there on the ground for a year or more. Mm-hmm. Marco Rubio, people on the ground for a long time. So I think that that made all the difference.
Mm-hmm.
And Rubio is supposed to be the shining light on the hill, so to speak, and supposed to be the savior of the Republican Party. But keep in mind, the last week he went way out to the right and got really kind of started trying to out-Trump Trump. And it looked like it helped him in Iowa. The question is, does it help in New Hampshire and after that?
Mm-hmm. These campaigns seem like they're pretty brutal. There's a grueling schedule. They spend a lot of time on the road, the candidates, so it must be difficult figuring out just where they're going to spend time. As Michelle was saying, some states they like to see them kind of get up close and personal with the voters. Other states they can spend a lot of money on an air war campaign and do well that way. Mm-hmm. How do they make those decisions?
Depending on how much money we got, number one, if they're going to be involved in the air war. But the one-on-one really helps because it makes good media also. So it's a combination of having the money to spend, being able to target where your turnout's going to be where you hope it's going to be. But the one-on-one still sells very well, as they say in Peoria.
Mm-hmm. Now, candidates are on their way to New Hampshire, as was pointed out. Jeb Bush already there holding an event last night in New Hampshire. They spent a bunch of time and money there over the summer. Let me just quote from something from the Washington Post. Here's what they wrote recently in the Post about Bush and New Hampshire. Quote, should he fail to gain traction, Bush's campaign will surely be remembered as an unmitigated disaster from start to finish. End quote. Michelle Ertel, is that a fair analysis? I mean, should Jeb's campaign have seen the signs, you know, when he entered the race?
Well, I think when he entered the race, he didn't count on Donald Trump. The minute Donald Trump got into the race, he sucked the air out of the room. So he has not had some face time. Make no mistake, Jeb Bush is incredibly smart. He would be a very good president. Some believe that the wrong Bush brother got in the White House the last time. But the timing seems to be off, and he isn't eliciting a lot of excitement from the crowds, as is Donald Trump and Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio. So I think a lot of it is timing.
And that seems to be frustrating Jeb Bush. You see that sort of coming through. He's like, look, don't look at the rhetoric, kind of look at my record.
But and he's a grown-up. He's the adult in the room, and I think that he wants to be, and so, by the way, is John Kasich. They all want to, the both of them need to stand there and say, I'm the adult in the room, please listen to me. But even when they do, nobody's listening.
Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on that, Dick Batchelor? Does that sort of sound accurate?
I agree with Michelle on that. I hate them. I hate to ruin her reputation by agreeing with her, but I agree with her on that. And she, oxygen was sucked out of the room by Donald Trump. And I feel badly. I mean, Jeb Bush was a good governor, not my politics, but he was a good governor. He's very thoughtful, very much of a policy wonk, knows what to do. He's got a plan for everything that you could throw at him. But he just can't get any traction because Trump sucks the oxygen completely out of the room. And
so
it's too late.
What kind of conversations are going? Excuse me. What kind of conversations are going on in Jeb Bush's camp now? You are saying that basically you don't think he can last beyond New Hampshire if he doesn't do a lot better than he did in Iowa.
He might make it to South Carolina, but you know, if the PACs continue to raise in money, they had $100 million at one time. They're probably down to maybe $20 million, $30 million now. They keep raising the PAC money. He can maybe get out of South Carolina. He could do probably well in South Carolina because of the strong military presence there and the support for his brother.
Mm-hmm.
But can he make it? He can't make it to March 15th, which is the Florida primary. And even if he did, he's in maybe fourth place in Florida.
Mm-hmm. Let me just read another little snippet. Here's a tagline from an article in Mother Jones magazine about Jeb Bush. This was published a few weeks ago in January. Quote, last year's most low-energy candidate is preparing to go down fighting, even if he has to take the entire GOP with him, end quote. Dick Batchelor, is this the story of this candidate, actually about a fundamental shift in the Republican Party? Is there something seismic going on here?
To the point you've got a candidate like Donald Trump, which is an unorthodox candidate. So really the Republican Party really is stymied right now because they really do not want Donald Trump as nominee. They do not want Ted Cruz as the nominee. So what happens? And again, is this a time for them to kind of get behind Marco Rubio now and the Republican establishment come out and start dumping money in to try to peel him apart from Donald Trump?
Mm-hmm. Michelle Ertel, if Rubio does continue to do well, if he does to continue to garner those endorsements, you know, what does that tell you about the future of the party?
I think that's good news for the party. Right now, we're fighting for the soul of our party. You have got Ted Cruz with the evangelicals. You've got Donald Trump with Donald Trump. And you've got all of the others. I think that Marco is an establishment candidate, but he's young and he's a new Republican. He's got new ideas. And while he's still conservative, he's open to a lot of things that some of the older Republicans were not.
Mm-hmm. He's changed positions a few times, too. If you look at immigration reform, could you see him kind of swing around again if he does become the nominee?
He's evolved. He's evolving. That's what they all do. We evolve.
I love that.
Is Marco Rubio the future of the GOP, Dick Batchelor?
I think if they were smart, they would pick somebody like Marco Rubio. Well, he has changed positions on a few things. He's a very bright guy. He's a very good debater. He's got some policy positions, which I don't agree with, but at least he's got some he can defend. And so they're going to have to pick somebody like Marco Rubio, and he would be the strongest candidate, I believe.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. We've been joined by Dick Batchelor, former Democratic State House lawmaker with analysis of the Iowa caucuses. Also joining us, Michelle Ertel, Republican political analyst, looking ahead to New Hampshire. Thank you so much for joining us, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And coming up next, Florida voters didn't quite vote for a broader medical marijuana reform in 2014, but supporters of medical marijuana have gathered enough votes again to put it on the ballot once more. We'll talk about the support and opposition to medical marijuana when Intersection returns in a minute. Welcome back to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. A ballot initiative to change the Florida Constitution and bring about broader legalization of medical marijuana went before voters in 2014 and failed. But this time, supporters say they're confident the measure will pass. Ben Pallera is the campaign manager for United for Care, which is behind the medical marijuana amendment that's heading to the ballot in November. Welcome to Intersection.
Thanks for having me.
Ben, obviously some cause for celebration getting enough signatures on the ballot, but there's still some work to be done, right?
There's a lot more to be done. We're going to be on the ballot again as Amendment 2 in the November general election. And unlike anything else on the ballot, constitutional amendments in Florida have to pass with a 60% supermajority. So last time we got 58%, which was a 500,000 more votes than Rick Scott was reelected with, but we still didn't win. So it's a big hurdle that we still have to cross in November.
Are you confident, though, that this being a presidential election year, that's enough to kind of make up that margin, get that extra 2% that you would need to get the 60%?
Yeah, and I'm really confident that the people of Florida are compassionate and supportive of this issue. I think the people of Florida believe that medical decisions should be made between a doctor and their patients, and that doctors who we allow to prescribe addictive, dangerous, in some cases deadly narcotics like Percocet and OxyContin and Xanax and Valium should be able to recommend the use of medical marijuana to really sick and suffering patients in the state. I don't think that's a controversial proposition, and I believe that's what's ultimately going to carry us over 60%.
So what's the plan from here on out? What do you now need to do to make sure things go smoothly as far as you're concerned up until November?
Listen, we just need to make sure our message gets out there. We're going to do a lot more paid advertising than we did last time. You're going to see us, on TV and on the internet and on the radio leading up to the election. We're going to start our advertising efforts earlier than we did last time. And we're just going to make sure that our message of, compassionate use of medical marijuana gets out there.
John Morgan made a comment in a press conference saying that he'd spent about $7 million trying to get this amendment through in the last few years. How expensive is it going to be? Like, how much more do you need to spend to make sure things go the way you want them to?
Yeah, well, listen, John has been an amazing chairman for this campaign. We would not be on the ballot either this time or last time if not for the extraordinarily generous contributions that he continues to give. But Florida is a big state, and it's an expensive state to run a television advertising campaign. It's an expensive state to put something on the ballot. So, I expect we'll probably spend another, $5 to $6 million between now and November trying to pass this thing.
What about opposition? Because there was a lot of opposition from some groups, last time around when you were unsuccessful with that 58%. Are you expecting them to be mobilizing now to get their campaign running?
I don't know, and I don't, keep myself up at night thinking about what the opposition is going to do. We have to run our campaign. We have to get out our message that medical marijuana really helps people, and it's not something that we're reinventing the wheel with. This is something that 23 states plus D.C. have done, and Florida should be the 24th. And so we can just keep our heads down and run our campaign and get out our message. I can't stay up nights worrying about what the opposition is going to do or not do.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned, the contrast between medical marijuana on the one hand and sometimes dangerous drugs, OxyContin. I mean, that's an argument that you'll hear opponents of medical marijuana make too. They'll say that if it's legalized, if this measure passes, then those dispensaries will spring up, and they make an analogy between those and pill mills. How do you push back against that kind of message?
Well, unfortunately for them, their argument has no basis in fact or reality. The reality is that marijuana in the history of human civilization has never killed a single human being from an overdose death. The reality is also that in states with medical marijuana laws on the books, they have seen a 25% drop in opiate overdose deaths in a year where they saw a rise in states without medical marijuana laws. So the notion that medical marijuana will lead to more drug use or a pill mill scenario is simply ludicrous.
As far as the difference in the campaign, too, I just want to come back to something that John Morgan was talking about in his press conference. He said that the focus is going to be a little different this time around, maybe less on the younger voters and more on older voters. How do you kind of tailor your message? Is that part of using different means to reach out to those potential voters come November? Like, will you be relying more on television than other media?
Yeah, and, you know, John has taken a lot of flack, and you know, he's taken his medicine on this, too, for the efforts to reach out to young voters in the campaign last time. But, you know, the bottom line is the paid advertising that we did in the last election was almost entirely focused on seniors. We knew from our polling, just as the opposition knew from theirs, that they were the most persuadable group and the ones that could cinch the election either way, which they ultimately did. So, you know, I think John really wants to spend more time talking directly to seniors, which he'll do, and certainly our paid communications efforts are going to be focused on seniors as well.
Mm-hmm. How do you see the young vote playing into that, though? What do you have planned for them? Because they must be an important part of your strategy as well.
Yeah, I mean, listen, we just got on the ballot Wednesday. All of our focus up to then was getting the petitions needed to get on the ballot. So we have not really formulated our general election plans yet. But this is a broadly supported issue. It's popular with young people. It's popular with middle-aged people. It's not as popular with older people, but we're going to hope to change that. So we're going to have, you know, we're going to have voter persuasion and turnout strategies for every demographic group, and I can't speak right this second to what specifically we're going to do with youth, but we're certainly going to be talking to everybody because we need 60% to win, and mm-hmm. you can't do that just on the backs of seniors or people between 35 and 55. You got to get broad support from everyone, which I think exists for medical marijuana here in Florida.
And you talked about doctors, obviously, that they would be the ones prescribing medical marijuana if this amendment goes through, but how do you reach out to those maybe more informed groups, because those must be a pretty critical part of the strategy as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we did a lot of outreach to physicians last time. We're going to do a lot more this time. I think it's very important not only that we're reaching out to physicians, but that we have physicians reaching out on behalf of the campaign and advocating for the passage of a medical marijuana amendment. So, you know, whenever possible, I would much rather have, you know, a doctor talking to you or, you know, going in front of a camera giving the case for medical marijuana versus, you know, a political consultant like myself. And that's something that you'll continue to see.
Mm-hmm. What kind of feedback have you had from people who have, you know, personal interest in this, if they're maybe waiting for some kind of relief or this is something they've been, you know, they're suffering from some of the diseases that you mentioned, ALS, cancer, et cetera? What have they said about the fact that there are now the signatures you need to move forward?
Oh, there's just, you know, there's a tremendous outpouring of support and gratitude. And, you know, this is a very challenging campaign to work on because every single day we get calls and emails and letters from people who are sick and suffering and dying or who have recently lost loved ones who are just so desperate for a medical marijuana law here in Florida. So it's what makes this an emotionally challenging campaign, but it's also what makes this a great campaign to work on and you know, get up every morning knowing you're really going to do something to help people.
Mm-hmm.
That's really the backbone of this campaign is the patients out there and the family of patients out there who are contacting us every day to tell us how important this is to them.
How long have you been working on this campaign for?
It has been almost 3 years now. John Morgan and I started this back in January or February of 2013.
Mm-hmm. Did you expect it would be this tough?
I did not. Listen, this has been, again, a great thing to do. It's something I'm really, really proud of. You know, you work for a candidate or a political party, you win or lose elections, and when you win, you know, your candidate almost always disappoints you in some way, but this is an issue where you can wake up in the morning and know that if you win, when you win, you're going to have a real, true, serious impact on people's lives, and that's a really cool thing to be able to do.
Mm-hmm. Do you see your involvement continuing beyond November if people vote for it in November?
Yeah, absolutely, because, you know, this is the biggest battle that we've got to fight, but it is not the war. Once we pass this thing, we've actually got to get a medical marijuana law implemented in the state of Florida. It doesn't just set itself up overnight. So
mm-hmm.
I'm certainly going to be there advocating for a strong medical marijuana system to implement this constitutional amendment once we pass.
And having seen how things have played out with Charlotte's Web, for example, I mean, does that give you some trepidation thinking about how this thing might actually be put into effect?
Yeah, I mean, I think the good thing about what's gone on with Charlotte's Web, which, you know, has been pretty much a disaster for the last couple of years. But I think the good thing that has come out of it is that the state is going through these growing pains now. And so when it gets time to implement a constitutional amendment, a lot of the initial challenges that they're going through and have gone through will already be done. So I think it'll be a much smoother process implementing a medical marijuana amendment, having gone through all these bumps in the road with Charlotte's Web.
Ben Pallera, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Ben Pallera, the campaign manager for United for Care, which is behind the medical marijuana ballot initiative. Well, not everyone's celebrating the return of medical marijuana to the ballot in 2016. Calvina Fay is the executive director of the Drug Free America Foundation. She joined us by phone from her office in St. Petersburg. Fay says she doesn't think the new measure will pass.
If people take the time to read the language in the ballot initiative, it's basically the same thing it was last time around. I know that the proponents of it are claiming that they closed the loopholes, but read it, they really didn't. And when people learn what this is really all about, they rejected it. They rejected it last time. So I really think that the voters are smart enough to figure this out.
What are your concerns with this amendment?
Well, it is still a ballot initiative. It would still alter our state constitution, which is not the way to go about, certainly not the way to go about creating what's considered medicine.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that is nowhere in the history of this country have we ever voted on anything as to whether it's medicine or not. We've always left that up to scientific research to figure out what is legitimate medication. And in our case, because we have a constitutional amendment process, this would be basically carved into our constitution. And if it were to pass and we later figured out that it was a disaster, which, trust me, we would figure that out, it would be very difficult to undo a ballot initiative.
As far as your concerns about what might happen immediately if this amendment, you know, if enough voters go for it come November and it does get signed into law, you know, what are your concerns about what it could do to the landscape of drugs in Florida?
Well, based on what we've seen in other states that have passed broad-reaching laws like this amendment proposes, it's been a very unpleasant experience for the people living in those states. We will recall that here in Florida, we had a very serious problem with prescription drugs. We will remember that we had what were called pill mills that popped up all over the state. That is what we would see if this amendment goes through, because it would allow pot shops to exist. And the health department here in Florida looked at this issue last time around, and they predicted that we would have, I don't remember the exact number, but it was around 1,700 pot shops across our state. So it would be a repeat. In fact, it would be worse, because we only had something like 900 and something pill mills in the state. So it would be twice as bad as what we saw with the pill mills.
But then you have people like, you know, John Morgan with United for Care saying, look, the problem with pill mills is they're peddling dangerous drugs, whereas if you're talking about marijuana, it's nowhere near as dangerous.
Well, he's not a scientist. He's not a doctor. And what he's saying runs very contrary to what research tells us and what our doctors tell us. When this amendment was on the ballot last time around, the physicians from the Florida Medical Association were one of the most vocal groups out there saying this is not the way to go about providing medicine for truly sick people. If you look at the research, it just does not support what he claims. Marijuana is, in fact, a harmful drug and does cause a lot of problems for a lot of people.
What about those people, though, who they may have cancer, they may have other debilitating illnesses, and, you know, they're looking for something, anything, and they're ready to try this? I mean, what do you say to those folks who are saying, look, just give us a chance to try it?
That's not what this ballot initiative is about. This ballot initiative does not address exclusively people who are in their last hours of life. This ballot initiative is wide open for anybody to use it for any reason whatsoever. It's not about medicine. It's not about the sick and dying. It's about legalizing an entire marijuana industry for pretty much anybody to be able to get it for any reason.
people who support the amendment are saying that last time they just did not have the turnout they needed. They got 58%, just 2% shy of getting the majority they needed there, but they're confident that this time there will be the numbers. Does that give you some concerns leading up until November?
Well, I think people have also learned a lot more about the problems that we're seeing in states like Colorado, California, Washington, Nevada, Arizona, on and on and on. I mean, the horror stories just keep coming out about the increase in impaired drivers, the increase in youth using, the increase in psychotic breaks from people who are under the influence of marijuana, the horror stories of THC being put into food products, including gummy bears and other candies, and being promoted to children. So, you know, our voters are getting more and more educated on this issue and smarter about the fact that this is really a scam, that it really doesn't have anything to do with medicine, that it's about normalizing and legalizing a huge marijuana industry where people in this industry are going to make a lot of money under the guise of it being a medicine and using sick people as they pad their pocketbooks. So, you know, more people showing up to vote doesn't necessarily mean they're going to be voting for it. I believe there'll be more people voting against it because they understand what a scam it is.
Kelvina Faye, when you talk about horror stories, some of the things you say are going wrong in some of those states where they do have broader legalization, though, I mean, do you have, you know, examples of those kind of incidences increasing, or is it more just there's a couple of stories and those tend to get a lot of attention because, you know, they are kind of sensational?
No, I look at the data. Now, I can't cite the data off the top of my head. I can certainly provide it for you. We keep it on file here. But I can tell you that if you just look at the state of Colorado, you know, they went from being something like number four in the nation of the percentage of young people that are smoking pot out there to being number one in the nation. If you talk to the heads of the poison control centers in both Colorado and Washington State, they will tell you they've had a huge jump in the number of calls coming into their poison centers. And, you know, all that data is public record. Anybody can access that.
Mm-hmm.
They've had a look at the reports on impaired driving with marijuana-impaired drivers in the states. Look at the numbers out in California. You know, the data is there. I don't look at anecdotal reports. I look at the data, and I'm very concerned with what I'm seeing.
Kelvina Faye, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for covering the issue.
Kelvina Faye is the Executive Director of the Drug Free America Foundation. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Coming up, there's another ballot initiative that voters might be looking at in November about solar energy. But as reporter Mitch Perry explains, it's not the initiative that a lot of supporters of solar energy were hoping for. Intersection returns in a minute. Welcome back to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. Florida may be the sunshine state, but some solar energy advocates say there's not enough being done to promote solar energy generation here. For the last year, canvassers have been gathering signatures for not one but two ballot initiatives which focus on solar energy, and that's been the cause of some confusion. Mitch Perry is a reporter for FloridaPolitics.com. He's been following the story about the solar initiatives. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for asking me.
Well, for a start, Mitch, I wonder if you could give us a quick background on the two competing solar initiatives, because it's a little bit complicated. What are they and who's backing them?
Right. Well, you had initially, beginning of the year, last year, you had Floridians for Solar Choice, which was made up of some environmentalists, but also both conservative and progressive folks who basically the constitutional amendment they were trying to get on the ballot would allow homeowners or businesses to buy or lease solar panels from a solar energy company and pay that company up to 2 megawatts of power. That kind of arrangement is not permissible today, and basically it offers more choice, if you will, for people here in the Sunshine State who complain that the utilities aren't providing those solar opportunities. So you had that going on. That started in earnest January of last year, and then about the middle of the year is when you had a competing measure come out, Consumers for Smart Solar. And that was a group that was backed by the public utilities, And essentially, their push is basically to keep things as they are. It says that it would allow current rules, allow customers to install solar panels, so as long as they pay for the installation and own the equipment. And basically, this other group, Consumers for Smart Solar, like I said, backed by the public utilities, has had a lot more funding and has been, to this date, more successful in terms of quite possibly getting on the ballot, although that's still up for, we don't know if that's going to happen yet or not.
Going back to Floridians for Solar Choice, the first group that was proposing their amendment, as you say, kind of an interesting bunch of supporters there, strange bedfellows in some cases. You've got environmentalists, libertarians, conservatives. What are your thoughts on the backing for that?
Yeah, basically, you did have what they call the Green Tea Coalition, a woman by the name of Debbie Dooley, one of the co-founders of the original Tea Party back in 2009, who has been working on these energy efforts in Georgia, was one of the big people to come down here to Florida to get this thing going. But they aligned with this environmental group called Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, who has basically been the main funder for Floridians for Solar Choice. And you had some conservative and progressive groups coming together on this, very grassrootsy, if you will. And they had all the energy, basically, starting out with this thing, because people have been complaining, I know, since I've been down here in Florida for 15 years now, covering these issues. And as we know, there's been a lot of unhappiness with the Public Service Commission and with public utilities, certainly in the Tampa Bay area, with Duke Energy. So you've had a lot of the consumers unhappy with the lack of choices in terms of going for alternative energy sources. And that's really what this group was all about, saying we're going to go ahead and have the people decide on this because Tallahassee is not allowing the public to have the opportunity to get more solar, for example.
Now, when you look at Consumers for Smart Solar, the group that then came in with their amendment, if you looked at their website, would you know that they were backed by the utilities?
No, you wouldn't. It would basically look like the same thing as the other group, where it's grassroots-oriented. But in fact, they are very much a group backed by the public utilities. And if nothing else, really to kind of muddy the waters in terms of these two measures. And basically, the way it's worked out, Matthew, they've been successful in that. Now, they still may get on the ballot. They announced that they had the sufficient number of signatures to qualify for the ballot in November. We'll see about that in terms of the court reviewing their language ultimately. But these people did not want Floridians for Solar Choice to be on the ballot by themselves at all.
One of the arguments you've heard, though, from that group, Consumers for Smart Solar, is they're basically saying it's going to be too expensive if you have people able to sort of buy energy offline, as it were. It's going to mean other people are going to be footing the bill to keep the grid going. Is that something that's really resonated with people?
Well, it's been an argument that they have made. Does it really work? I'm not sure. I think, frankly, Matthew, the argument hasn't been on the issues themselves. There's been a lot of confusion put onto this. But right, that has been one of their leading arguments. And the other group denies that that's going to be the case at all. But as it stands right now, Consumers for Smart Solar has been much more successful, right, in terms of if you want to say about who's going to get on the ballot and who's not. They've qualified to get on the ballot. Floridians for Solar Choice has already announced that they're not going to make it in 2016, and that's a big loss for them. And they're very bitter about the other group for coming in and basically having a lot more money and, as they would say, jimmying up the situation here and making a lot of confusion in terms of what the public, where they should go, what would they think would be the best move for them.
Mitch Perry, what happens now for the Floridians for Solar Choice Amendment? You say they're a little bitter by the way things have turned out. Are they giving up, though?
Yeah. Well, they're not giving up overall. They are giving up for 2016, though. We are not going to have – well, at this point, we may not have either of these measures on the ballot yet. But Floridians for Solar Choice announced in December, late December, and then they announced again a couple weeks ago that they're not going to make it in 2016. They are not going to have the 683,000-plus signatures to get on the ballot. But they still can continue to collect signatures, and they are doing that. Their goal now is to get on 2018. They feel confident that they will, and they'll be able to withstand the challenge of this other movement. Now, Consumers for Smart Solar, they do have the signatures. We're going to see if they're going to be qualified for the ballot. Floridians for Solar Choice says they will not. They say that their language is too confusing and the court will strike it down. We'll wait and see about that. So certainly the folks from Floridians for Solar Choice say that the other group was never sincere in the first place about getting a measure on the ballot, that they were more there to confuse people and to basically spend a lot more money. You know, one of the things that we reported on was how they were able to pay signature gatherers a higher rate, which made it much more competitive and much harder for a grassroots group like Floridians for Solar Choice to compete with them on that. And so, you know, in a way, Consumers for Smart Solar has already won this battle, if you will, which is that they wanted to make sure that that ballot measure was not on the 2016 ballot, and it's not going to be.
Mitch Perry, you mentioned before that there's been some frustration that you've noticed in your time reporting in Florida about maybe the lack of opportunities or choices when it comes to alternative energy. What about when you look at the lawmakers up in Tallahassee? What's the climate like there, so to speak? Is there an appetite for looking at alternatives to the energy generation there is now?
Shockingly, there's not. And this is where there's been, I think, one of the things when people feel that their government's not working for them, where they feel a disconnect. I mean, I was mentioned here in the Tampa Bay area, in Pinellas County specifically, where it was Progress Energy and now it's Duke Energy is the energy company here. There's just been a lot of frustration that lawmakers have not been more receptive to trying to open up the market, as it were. And you've also got the PSC, the Public Service Commission, which is these members that are really the ones that have a lot of power in terms of dictating what the power companies can do here or not do here. And they have given them a very free rein in terms of what they want. And again, I'm talking about the big major power companies here. And that's been very frustrating. That's led to some efforts in the last couple of years legislatively to maybe even rein in the PSC a bit. But for a lot of people, it still hasn't been nearly enough. And that's why, again, just like a lot of measures we have here in Florida, right, that is the beauty, if you will, of the constitutional amendment process. It allows citizens directly to try to change things in state government that their lawmakers are not responding to. Of course, it's not easy to do that because when you have these citizen initiatives, you need to get 60% of the popular vote. We saw this a couple years ago with medical marijuana, which had a lot of support. I think it almost got 58%. It didn't get 60%. It was a very high bar to reach, and that's why they're coming back around this fall. Yeah, I think there's been a lot of unhappiness with Tallahassee lawmakers in responding to what people in Florida want, because we're in many ways we have less choice on getting alternative energy sources than many other states in the country. You hear the sponsors of Floridians for Solar Choice talk about how New Jersey has more solar power than Florida does, and a lot of people think that doesn't make any sense.
Just back to the Consumers for Smart Solar Amendment, if that does make it onto the ballot, I'm wondering if you've heard Mitch Perry from the other group, Floridians for Solar Choice, whether they're going to keep up their publicity campaign and encourage people not to sign that amendment when it comes to voting time in November.
You know, I haven't heard definitively, but I would think that that would be the case. Yeah, again, I think they're going to save whatever money they make into collecting signatures. I'm not sure, you know, their strategy, but right, they don't want that to go through. Again, the critics would say of Consumers for Smart Solar that it's not even really changing much of anything. You know, I don't know if it makes it harder ultimately for Floridians for Solar Choice to get, you know, more choice ultimately or not. So I don't know if there will be a sustained effort against it. Persuasion-wise, they'll certainly do whatever they can to tell people that it's not an effective issue and it's not going to really help people. And I guess what would be really interesting, now these people have a lot of money, these utilities, is if they do get on the measure, you know, will they spend a lot of money to make sure it gets passed by putting television commercials on and the like? You could say that it will work for them to do that. It would kind of look a little unusual if they didn't go out for a fuller campaign once they actually get the measure on the ballot. But I would go back to the idea that I think the proponents have been successful in a way because they've thwarted the more grassroots effort from even having the chance to get on the ballot at this point.
Mitch Perry is a reporter for FloridaPolitics.com. He's been following the story of the competing solar initiatives, and he'll be following them as we make our way through to November. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks very much.
Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. The executive producer is Catherine Welch. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.